From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a U.S. Air Force intelligence officer named Sarah Maples left the military. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, she is one of about 2 million female veterans in the United States, and Maples has been outspoken about how difficult it was for her to transition to civilian life. In a 2017 piece for the Atlantic Monthly, she wrote, quote, "When many women leave the service, they expect that being a woman in the civilian community will be easier, but that isn't always the case. They have to prove their abilities all over again, earn their place at the table again. As veterans, they're not afraid to prove themselves. They prove themselves in boot camp. They prove themselves at tech training. They prove themselves every time they arrived at a new duty station. They have plenty of practice proving themselves. They can prove themselves one more time. The difference this time is that the individuals on the other end are not prepared for them to do so," end quote. And research shows female veterans are nearly twice as likely as civilian women to die by suicide. They report a lack of social supports, health supports, and unique financial, employment, and home life challenges not faced by their male counterparts. In addition, a 2016 survey reported that 74% of female veteran respondents said the general public did not recognize their service. Women vets report feeling invisible and isolated. An arts program in Rochester is seeking to change that. Flower City Arts Center has partnered with the Rochester Vet Center on Eyes Front, a photography and writing project aimed at empowering female veterans to share their stories with each other and with the community. The result of that project is a book called First Light, and we invited some of the First Light co-authors to join us on the program this hour. We'll talk about their stories and what they learned during the program, and I think this is important and instructive for all of us to hear these stories. Let me welcome our guests in studio. Megan Sharland is Director of Photography and Digital Arts at Flower City Arts Center. Megan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Jennifer Weiss, who is a veteran, social worker at the Rochester Vet Center, and a participant in the Eyes Front program. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us, Evan.
And Jade Starr is a veteran and a participant in the Eyes Front program. Jade, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with just making sure we understand what the Rochester Vet Center is and the mission it has. Jennifer, tell us about that.
Absolutely. So we are part of the Veterans Health Administration. And back during the Vietnam era, our Vietnam veterans were coming home and they were struggling. We all know that. We know that story. We also know that our veterans, our incredibly courageous Vietnam veterans, actually went to Congress. And in 1979, they came up with this idea of vet centers. And what they are, our vet centers today, they're community-based. We're part of the Veterans Health Administration, but in a very distinctive way, we're separate from the medical centers. And we provide individual, family, couples, and group counseling, as well as alternative therapies, to our returning war zone veterans. And we've also expanded that. We also now work with anyone in the military who has experienced military sexual trauma. And we also have the privilege and the honor of working with our Gold Star families. And our Gold Star families are the families who have lost somebody on active duty.
Hmm. Well, as we go throughout this hour, strange as this may sound, I want to offer a note up front so as not to offend anybody. I already have a note from a listener who does not like the way I say the word veteran. A lot of people say veteran. Some people say veterans. Technically, if you look it up, the answer is both are correct. Though I've been chastened on this before, so I changed to saying veteran about a year ago, and then a listener complained that I was saying it wrong then. So what I would like to say is if it bothers you the way I say it, I do apologize, and I'm not trying to offend or get it wrong. Now, on the subject of what Flower City Art Center is doing, Megan, tell us a little bit about how this came together.
So we have over 20 years experience working with particular populations for specialized photography programming. Our Studio 678 Youth Photography Program, we're in our 22nd year working with middle school students. And what 2 years ago, my colleague Sharon Turner and I really wanted to start working with women veterans. It was something that, for me personally, I have veterans in my family, and I was looking for a project that would support them, even if in spirit. And, you know, allowing them to use our darkroom facilities, giving them the space to create and really get to express their creativity in a way that they may not otherwise be able to do so.
I'm holding the book, First Light, Eyes Front, Images and Words from Women Combat Veterans 2019. It's gorgeous.
Thank you.
Where can people find it?
So on our website, rochesterarts.org, there is a link for Eyes Front, and you can make a $20 donation and receive a copy of the book. So 100% of those proceeds support the next cohort, because we're already planning for Eyes Front 2020. Also, if you want to stop by Flower City Art Center, we're at 713 Monroe Avenue. You can pop in, and we've got extra copies of the book that you can bring home with you.
Jade, I have to say, just reading your writing, it's really, really powerful and moving stuff.
Thank you.
And I'm really grateful that you're willing to contribute to this. And so what I'd like to first do is hear about your service. And then with your permission, I'd love to read, or if you want to read some of what you've written, I think it's really, really valuable to hear that. But tell us a little bit about your service first.
Sure. Let me see. I joined when I was 16. Couldn't wait to get away from home, to be honest. It was in 2000, so it
where
was
home? Where'd you grow up?
Greece,
right,
in
okay.
Rochester.
In Greece, yeah.
And so I left at 17. I had to have my parents sign for me, but it was before the war. You know, the whole recruiter promising that there's not going to be another war for 100 years. But it happened. I went reserves first. After a year and a half, it wasn't enough. I went active duty. I was stationed in Fort Lee, Virginia, at a TRADOC post, and from there I deployed to Iraq. We were stationed, we worked on the Baghdad airport, and our living quarters were right next to Abu Ghraib, where that, I'm not sure if I'm saying that
right. The prison
right.
Abu Ghraib, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where that prison scandal was.
Yes.
We were there for a year, and we came home. It's, you know, and everything in between.
When you said you're stationed near Abu Ghraib, but what was the kind of daily work that you did there like?
So I was part of a quartermaster job. We set up showers. It is port. Mm-hmm. Set up showers, laundry units, stuff like that to basically give morale to a lot of pretty stinky soldiers.
How hard was it, and what do you think the public does not realize about the day-to-day grind of the work?
The work itself wasn't so difficult. I think the hardest part is really the hours. You know, it's not like here where you work 8 hours, you get paid extra overtime. It's just you work until you're done. The heat, it's just stifling, and being away from family, really. When I was there, it was before there was, you know, cell phones that you could use overseas. It was, we used those old green military ones where we had to collect, and we had 10 minutes a day to talk to our family. Few times I accidentally said things I wasn't supposed to, and my calls would get cut off, stuff like that. You know, it's just a whole different world. It's nothing like what you're used to, what you grow up with, or what you're prepared for when you go over there. But you learn to adapt, but it definitely changes you.
What about you has changed the most?
I don't know. I'd say I'm not as positive as a person I used to be. I'm a lot more negative. I'm harder on myself. The whole 22 veteran a day thing is real. It's very, very real. I've been in those moments myself. But I think I'm stronger. I'm definitely emotionally stronger than I ever was.
Now, when you look at the service, your service, and you think back to that, the recruiter telling you, well, we're not going to have another war for 100 years, which is probably a somewhat common line. I've heard that before.
Oh, yeah, many times.
Yeah. If you had known what was coming, would you still have enlisted?
Yes. Yeah. I probably wouldn't have done reserves. I would have gone all out and joined active duty to begin with. But I was 17. It was almost a game. you know, it didn't really hit me until I was there. But then that's when the pride comes in of the uniform you're wearing and the people beside you, and even in your job, it's, you grow up fast, for sure.
This country, it's an interesting view of what war is. If you ask people, are we at war, even for 20 years, even after, maybe shortly after 9/11 and maybe with the invasion of Iraq, but for the most part, people will say no, you know, ignoring or not even really being all that well aware of our deployments around the world. What was your perception of what the American public knew about what was happening, and whether it was respected or honored?
Well, you know, I'd say about the first 4 or 5 years after 9/11, it was pretty common. You know, you would hear it on the radio, you would hear about it on the news, and I think there was you'd see a lot more bumper stickers, support veterans and stuff like that. And now it's almost like it's old. And I don't think people understand and respect, even though that there's fewer soldiers over there, of what they are still dealing with on a day-to-day basis, that there is still, you know, mortar attacks and RPGs and, you know, roadside bombs and veterans coming back in caskets. Like, it's still happening. And I think that the public has just moved on from it, which is extremely unfortunate.
How long were you in Iraq?
For a year.
For 1 year. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, you talk about the heat, that's one thing, but what was for you, the most tension, or was there a sense of danger or concern on a daily basis?
Yes, we were, mm-hmm. where we were mortared daily. Live fire coming over. Actually, the night before we left our deployment, someone from a Washington unit on our compound died from a collapsed lung from shrapnel. It literally daily. And if it wasn't because of that, or not just because of that, lack of sleep. Whether it was because of the heat or the attacks or just working, we definitely had to learn to, you know, put one foot forward with one eye closed, kind of thing.
So as we talk about reintegration to civilian life, what was your process like in doing that?
Extremely difficult. Very, very difficult. I had nightmares, night terrors, panic attacks that I developed overseas, depression I needed medication for. I had a hard time getting close to my family again, to my fiance at the time. And a lot of the different aspects of a woman's life that makes them happy was kind of non-existent for me. And for a lot of us, we just, you know, had to try to deal. And you were right, there are a lot of people that look at female vets and be like, well, it's not like you're on the front lines, you know, or, you know, there's no way you dealt with what men deal with overseas. And it's so not true. Even though I was a support job, and, you know, we were in an area where it was dangerous and it was scary, and though it wasn't the front lines, it didn't change the reality of it. And women hurt just like men do, you know. And I some female vets that I've spoken to, myself included, hold it in more than men do, to be honest, because we feel like we need to be stronger for our families, for our children, you know, for our spouses.
When your perception is that people think, well, women don't have to deal with what men do in the service, do people say that outright to you?
I've had it happen, yes. Yeah, more of like a snicker, roll off your shoulder kind of thing. No offense, but offense taken. But yeah, it happens.
Do you respond?
I kind of chuckle, you know. I laugh a little because, you know, ignorance is definitely bliss.
Now, are there transition classes? Are there support services that you were able to utilize?
Not myself, personally. I know that there are. I'm not sure what was around the time I was there. I went from 2003 to 2004. But when I got out, I was dealing a lot of personal stuff, and I didn't seek help. It really wasn't until about 2 years ago that I started seeking help from the VA and the Vet Center. and it's changed my world. But I know that there are many things that veterans can do to get the help. They just have to ask.
Are you surprised at how long the deployment in Iraq has been, and certainly Afghanistan as well, but you know, in 2019, are you surprised at how long our country had been in Iraq and how long it's been in Afghanistan?
I am, yes. I can understand initially why we were there, but from my personal experience, you know, dealing with civilian contractors in Iraq and civilian contractors where my ex-husband was in Afghanistan, they don't want us there. You know, they live completely different than we do. And I don't know, I don't feel one way or another anymore whether we should be there to help, but I am surprised it's been this long, to be honest.
I want to read something that, as we mentioned off the top here, a U.S. Air Force intelligence officer named Sarah Maples wrote a piece for The Atlantic on what she and women have gone through. And she wrote, quote, "On active duty, women were my support network, a situation encouraged both by our small numbers, approximately 15% of the active duty force is women, and by the military's emphasis on teamwork. My experiences with civilian women, however, have not always been as friendly. Other women veterans have also reported negative experiences with civilian women, ranging from lack of understanding and inability to relate to cold shoulders," end quote. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah.
Why do you think that happens?
I think because, you know, for many years, the military going overseas war, it was just for men. And now you're throwing women into the mix where, you know, they do have roles in their families and at home, and that a lot of men don't fulfill. And then you're putting them in a completely different, you know, scenario to deal with what men do, and then come back to do that. And there's a lot of women that don't get it. They don't understand why you would put yourself through that to begin with, you know, how you could survive or keep your head on straight. It generally is, I think, they just don't understand. They can't fathom why we would do what we do.
I'm looking at First Light, Eyes Front, Images and Worlds, and Words from Women Combat Veterans. Why did you decide that you wanted to be part of it?
Well, I see a counselor myself for PTSD and MST at the Vet Center, and she brought it up to me. She said that Jennifer was doing it, and I love art. I've just never really participated in it. But I said, why not? I have two children. I'm a single mother. And I was like, what could it hurt? You know, trying something different. And I am thoroughly, thoroughly happy that I did. It opened my eyes to different expressions, to get things off my chest or things that I find myself not being able to talk to people about that's just on my mind. And I mean, it helps. It was an awesome time with some amazing women.
So in Jade's section, there are a number of pages of writing. And I'd love to start with the word you despise. The word, as you say, one word with more meanings than most. And if you'd like, I'd love you to read it. Or if you'd rather, can I read it? Is that all right with you?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll read it, and then I'd love to hear more of your thoughts on it. A word I despise, one word with more meanings than most. It's physical and emotional. I say weakness. I was strong during deployment. I was weak at home. Because of my weakness, I was banished, given up on, walked away from, let go. So I fell. I fell right into that weakness, and I evolved. I succeeded at acting strong, but inside I was weak. So here I am, years later, facing that weakness I harbored. I try with all my might to meet the stranger to me called strength. Do you still feel that weakness?
I don't, actually.
Okay.
It was, I was raised that crying, whining, stuff like that was a weakness. And that's how my father raised me. Mm. And, but I had, after a few years of my deployment, I started having a lot of physical pain. And I ended up developing an addiction, which from what I've heard is pretty common.
It certainly is.
especially with vets. But to me, that was my weakness. And I have since gotten help. I've gone to the VA. I talked to another counselor, and I am past it. I believe that I am stronger than I was 6 months ago, way stronger. And this writing was when I was right on the verge of asking for help but not ready, kind of thing. So I've definitely gotten past it.
Wow. How do you feel about crying and emotional displays now?
I'm still not a fan.
You're still not?
No. Absolutely not.
I think it's a sign of strength.
Oh, maybe. I think it's tiring and ugly.
Oh, wow. How confident or comfortable are you thinking about your own future, knowing the addiction you struggled with, that as you said, is not uncommon, but it can be life-taking? And now as you look at the future, how do you feel about moving into that future, moving forward, getting the help that you've gotten, and dealing with it?
To be honest, I see a future, just period. I didn't, like I said, 6 months ago, I didn't see a future. I literally lived day by day. I did what I had to do for my children, very rarely for myself. And I didn't dare hope for a future, kind of thing. And I couldn't see one, but now I do. I've, you know, just by putting one foot in front of the other and asking for help, I have already grown leaps and bounds, and, you know, it personally, financially, as a mother. And I see a future.
What's it look like?
It looks successful. It giving my children what they need, which I wasn't sure I could give them at one time. Giving them a home, you know, just doing the everyday things that most women that have their stuff together are able to do. And I can finally do that.
I'm going to read a little bit what you say about time, if we could. Is that all right?
Sure.
So this is Jade writing about time. And you write, "Lately I've felt shambled. I'm in between one toxic reality and one possibly beautiful future. I want one, but need the other. Lately, I don't know which is which. At odd moments, I am half full with hope and strength. I struggle during the rest of my moments. My head hurts, my body screams, my heart knows the love I have and why I must cease. Time. That's what I need to want." Tell me a little bit more about your thoughts about time.
That's almost exactly what I already said about the other one. That's really what it was, is I wanted a future. PTSD and depression is literally and figuratively a killer. And I have dealt with depression for many years, even before my deployment, but it really just was, you know, it took the cake kind of thing. And I have had suicidal moments and tendencies, where I didn't care if I survived. You know, it was, my children would be better off without me. My family would be better off without me. You know, what do I bring to make anybody's lives better? And I couldn't see myself having grandchildren and seeing my kids get married or anything like that. And that's what I wanted to want more. You know, I wanted to see the future and, you know that it's going to be okay and that I'll get there.
And I'll close the section here on Jade's section of the book. Can we read the letter to yourself in the future?
Sure.
"Dearest Jade," you write, a letter to your future self, essentially. "Dearest Jade, do not fear. I know you. I am a later Jade. I know your thoughts and fears. I know your tears. I've cried them too. I tell you now, the pain you feel, it won't disappear. Please have faith and know some things. They will get easier. The one you love, I know she hurts you, but one day soon, her clutch on you will ease. I know you hate to look in the mirror. You need to know you are beautiful. You will be smart, you will be loved, and you will be strong enough. I write to tell you, don't give up, sweet. I also write to warn you, do not run. Get help when you need it. and do not fear being alone. No one can fill your heart with what you need. Look in that mirror and see. You are all you need. Make your mistakes. It's okay. Worry not, love. You will be incredible. That is beautiful.
Thank you.
But I'll ask you about one specific part of it where you urge yourself, do not run. Probably figuratively and literally, but what's the danger in for you personally in running? What does that mean? Shielding yourself from your problems, not confronting them?
Absolutely. More than anything, bottling it up. You know, not facing it. You know, no self introspection is incredibly, you know, fulfilling, and it definitely helps you. And that was one thing that I didn't do for many years. I wouldn't look at myself and say, why am I being like this, or why am I reacting like this? Or, but within the past few years, I am looking into my past and understanding more about myself, which I couldn't do before. And, you know, not facing these things to me is also a weakness. That I'm still not a huge fan of opening up, but I do to more people than I have in the past, specifically my counselor. but it's one more person than I did before, and it's helped. So, you know, not holding things in and not running from truths or the past, I think definitely makes you stronger.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing the story, and I'm going to ask our listeners, when they pick up this beautiful, terse book here, they'll see more of the image. It's hard to describe photography images on a radio format, but briefly, tell me a little bit about what you wanted to represent in these visual images.
Sure. Which ones?
Well, I mean, if you want to just kind of give me a general sense on if there was one that really stood out to you, or kind of how you used the visual image to portray something.
All right, so I think out of the ones that I put in the book, the one that I could actually kind of describe about what I was feeling and seeing was the tree. If you look at the tree, the bark actually looks like there's a heart in the middle. And on the right of the tree, there's just a couple little branches you see. But on the left, it's a full-grown tree. You know, there's more over there. And to me, it was... symbolically, it doesn't matter whether you have a little or a lot, love is really all you need. And as ridiculous as that may sound, it's true. You know, whether if it's a friend or your children or yourself, you know, that doesn't matter how hard it gets, that there's always a positive.
Jade Starr, veteran, participant in the Eyes Front program. Her words and her work you can find in First Light, and I am so grateful that you're willing to tell your story.
Thank you.
And I truly find your voice inspiring, and that's part of the goal that the Flower City Art Center had when they partnered with the Rochester Vet Center and they created this project. So after our only break of the hour, we'll come back and we're going to talk to Jennifer Weiss, not only from the Rochester Vet Center, but a participant in this project as well. Megan Charland is here from the Flower City Art Center. You just heard Jade Starr. And we're getting ready for Veterans Day and all that it entails in a country here that sometimes forgets about the sacrifice and service. Let's take that break right here in Connections.
I'm Megan Mack. Monday on The Next Connections. On Veterans Day, we talk with refugees who served the U.S. military in Afghanistan and Iraq and who have come to America on special immigrant visas. They share the challenges they faced in bringing their families to safety in the U.S. Then in our second hour, according to the Department of Labor, the veteran unemployment rate has been on the decline, but vets report hurdles in reentering the workforce. We hear their stories.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to get a phone call. Rich in Rochester wants to weigh in on what he's hearing. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how are you doing, Evan?
Very good, sir. How are you?
I'm doing good. You know, I know a few female vets, and I think one thing that, which is so insidious, is that the thing that the Army teaches them, the military teaches them, assertiveness, leadership skills, just being a stronger person, I think within our society is looked down upon in women. I have an example of an interview I was part of, an interview process, and she was a female vet. She was very assertive. She was very reassuring. I liked her. But one of the people, and it was a woman who said, I think there's something wrong with her, because the first interview we asked her a question and she didn't have the answer. And the second interview, she had the answer. I said, so that means she went back and she learned it? And how is that an issue? And then she goes, well, she's, you know, she may even be after your job. There's this thing that the attributes that we see that are good in men and good leadership attributes, so many people don't like in women. And this leaves these women in a place in our everyday civilian society that is just not good. It's so insidious. And I've seen it, and I've firsthand, and I just watch it, and I just reflect on it. It's just, it's a bad thing. And I don't know if your guest has experienced that in her experiences since she's been out of the military.
Sir, I'll tell you, absolutely. I'm not going to lie. I'm not an unattractive person, but it is extremely hard to date. There are a lot of men that are that I come in contact with that are intimidated by me or my strength or, you know, my past. So it happens quite often, honestly, and thank you for thinking that.
Yeah, that was a pretty real phone call. And Rich, I appreciate that. But what do we do about that, Jade? What's gonna change that dynamic?
Honestly, I'm not sure what you do to change it, but you can really not care. Just move forward and know that, you know, that you can't change how people perceive you. You know, I mean, you can't, to a point, but I think what makes you a better person is if you just don't care and you love yourself for your strengths, and you find someone that respects you for who you are and for your past and everything, you know, that makes you you.
Do you think, generally speaking, it's harder to date for women who have been in the service?
Like I said, personally, yes, I do.
And I have a nod over here from Jennifer Weiss. We're going to jump into your story in a moment, but do you want to kind of respond to some of Rich's call on that theme, too? You think it is harder to date for women post-service, yeah?
Absolutely. Luckily, my husband knew me pre-military, so he already knew who I was. And he's definitely not one to be intimidated by someone who is more assertive or self-assured. He actually appreciates that. So I lucked out, but I know a lot of people, a lot of my fellow female veterans who have really struggled with finding somebody who, you know, somebody who isn't intimidated and somebody who welcomes that assertiveness.
Hmm. Jennifer is a social worker at the Rochester Vet Center, and also you'll find some of her work in the book we're talking about, in the Eyes Front program here. Tell me about your service.
Sure. So my story is a little bit different. I started later. I actually had graduated from St. Bonaventure with a bachelor's in psych, and I was working in Buffalo for a not-for-profit, and one day I decided I wanted to jump out of airplanes, and making, I don't know, probably $10.50 an hour at the time, I really couldn't afford to do it. I come from a military family. I have three stepbrothers who all served in different ways. And I thought, well, maybe I should explore this. I love my country. I love what we stand for, and I would love nothing more than to serve it. And if I could jump out of airplanes and get paid to do it, well, that's kind of two birds with one stone. So I contacted a recruiter. I let him know that I was interested in joining, that I was only interested in the reserves, and I wanted something that was somewhat in line with some of the education that I'd already gotten. I settled into an MOS called Civil Affairs, which I, you know, often describe as the Peace Corps with M16s or M4s. Some people may like that or not like that, but it's just kind of what I thought of. You know, we work with civilian populations and working on the infrastructure and winning those hearts and minds of whatever host nation we're in. So I joined in 2000, and in 2002, I got a call that we were going to be activated. 2003, there we were crossing the border into Iraq, for the invasion. And I was actually attached to 1st Marines and the British Army initially for the first 9 months. And then we actually transferred over to 4th ID. So initially we were in the south, moved up north to Baqaba, and served out the rest of my time up there.
What was the day-to-day like there?
The day-to-day life was anything but predictable. So most days we were out of the gate, and we were meeting with, different governments, different government representatives. We were also working with the civilians. We held some of the first elections. We did a lot of road rebuilding, university rebuilding. A number of the schools that were rebuilt were based off of a lot of the work that I did. I was also charged with going into the market every day, or I'm sorry, weekly, and I was monitoring for inflation. So with my limited Arabic, I was talking with the vendors, making sure that there wasn't any price gouging going on. And that was just some of the work that we were doing. We also did patrols. We were with the infantry. So as they were doing raids and whatnot, we were part of taking the civilians, the women, the children, or other people that they weren't looking for, and, containing them to keep, people out of the way. It really just kind of based on mission need, whatever was needed, that's where we were.
What do you think the public misunderstands about either your service there or the service generally?
I think unfortunately Hollywood colors the military in ways that, in some respects, yes, they're spot on. But in other ways, I think there's a lot of misconception about the true fear that happens when you are in, a foreign place and, there are IEDs, mortars, and rockets raining down. That stuff's real. And in the military, in Hollywood, you can press rewind and, the people are still there. That doesn't happen in real life. And what does happen is final, it's forever. So the finality of it, I think, is what a lot of people don't necessarily get, that when our men and our women are over there, every day, it doesn't matter if you're out of the gate or if you're in the gate, because war as we know it has changed. There are no front lines, and anything is possible. So even, if you are in a base, you are getting mortared. You're getting rocketed. And I think that stays with people. That's the other piece I think that the public misses, that 1 year, 2 year, 3 years post-deployment, it doesn't mean that it goes away. It doesn't mean that, that part of your life is over. Actually, what I've noticed in my work is a lot of times it takes 3 to 5 years for some of these things to catch up. And that's when we start seeing people for the first time. We see them 3 to 5 years out when, the sleep deprivation is so significant, or they've looked around and they find themselves without friends because their, behaviors or interactions just kind of led them to that. So that is part of what I believe, maybe the public misses.
How was it for you, reintegration?
So I tend to stuff myself with a lot of different taskings. And make no mistake, I did that straight out of the gate on my way back. 2 days after I got back, I bought a house. Because that makes sense, right? And
give yourself a big project.
No kidding. It actually ended up, it was actually my childhood house. And it came on the market the day after I got back. So 2 days after I put an offer in, they accepted it, and that was that. And then I kind of had my work cut out for me. A year after that, I got married. And a year after that, I had my amazing daughter. So, and I went back to graduate school. And I switched from the Army to the Air Force because with my daughter, I knew that we were slated to deploy again. And I wanted a little bit of time before the next deployment. So the Air Force had an opening for mental health technician. And with that being where I wanted to go with my career, you know, starting the social work program at UB, I decided that that was the place for me, that I would be able to once again align my civilian with my military work so that I didn't have to be a subject matter expert in two areas. Mm-hmm. I could kind of do it together as one.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the work that you've put together in the book here. Sure. As well, if we could, because again, it's photography, and in your case, it's poetry. And can I read history? Do you mind?
Sure.
I'm going to read a poem that Jennifer wrote called History, but it's coupled with a photograph with a street sign, and it's a dead end sign. So I want to know more about that, because that kind of creates an interesting tenor to it here. Here's the poem, History. To know your story, the journey that is yours, the gains, the losses, standing the test of time, guiding others as you stand firmly in your own truth, bearing witness to those passing by, carving their own path. With two signs, a one-way sign and a dead-end sign. Tell me a little bit about that choice.
Well, to be honest, I was actually walking with Jade at the time.
It was their first day.
It was. I say that photograph was from the very first day.
Yeah, that was our first
field trip.
I was actually about to take the same one, and then you did. I was like, well, never mind.
And there was just something about it. There was something about, and if you see it, you know, it's actually a dead end sign that's morphed. Because there's a bunch of stickers on it.
Yeah, it's almost like play. It's interesting.
Right. Yeah.
I see a couple of Grateful Dead stickers. Mm-hmm. There's some others.
And they've kind of changed the wording to deadhead, right?
Yeah.
So I was just completely drawn to it. I think for a lot of the reasons that you mentioned, right? There's just such a play on words. There's so many visuals about it, and I liked that there were different stickers. I felt like everybody kind of left their mark on it. And as I think that's kind of like life, right? So we're all moving through this life and we all kind of put our markers on things. And then they're for people to notice or not to notice. So people can, you know, bear witness to, you know, the changes that you've made. Or they can pass by, and that's their choice.
I'll tell you, as your reader, how it hits me when I see a dead-end sign that's been changed that much. And your poem is about history, carving our own paths. Mm-hmm. It's the idea that a dead-end is not necessarily a dead-end, and that even that can be changed. I just found that pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. I'd like to read I Carry You With Me, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Because accompanying that is... Monuments to those lost in Iraq and Afghanistan. There you are, I see you, captured in time, forever young, that smile, unable to do the things we do as we grow old, unable to know what is today. I carry you with me, speaking your name, telling a small part of your story. I did not know you well, in passing a few simple exchanges, but I was there in that moment. I carry you with me, telling your story, getting to know you, introducing you to others. There you are, here I am, living for you, for the others. I carry you with me. A clear honoring of those lost in Iraq and Afghanistan. I imagine there's no one who served who doesn't know someone or didn't experience someone who was lost. Is that fair?
And I think that's very fair. This particular writing piece is actually a nod to Specialist Charles Bush Jr., who is on that Iraq memorial. December 19th, 2003, we were on a convoy. It was a logistics run, just a standard logistics run from Fob Gabe to Anaconda. Actually, ironically, on that day, my brother, who was also in the Army, was at Anaconda, and I was hoping to run into him because I literally hadn't seen him, goodness, in 3 years. So I thought, wouldn't that be ironic if we could run into each other in Iraq? But on our way, there's a long stretch of road right next to that runs parallel to Anaconda, and we ended up taking a loss in a number of injuries, and that loss was Charles Bush. So whenever I am speaking about my experience, I mention him. And I do that because he's not here to mention himself anymore. And I think it's important that his legacy lives on. He has a great smile. Like I said, I didn't know a lot about him, but I continue to learn about him every day going forward. And there's not a day that goes by that I don't think of him, or I don't think of Master Sergeant Jackson or Sergeant Davis, who both took really serious injuries on that day. I think of them all the time. And, you know, they're part of my work. They're part of my path. They're part of my journey. And, it's something that stays with you.
I think the work of Karen Van Meenen should be recognized as a writing teacher for this program, because it really is remarkable reading the poetry and the writing as part of this project. So the great Karen Van Meenen helped out there. And then, of course, the visual images. You've got this awesome picture of a tree looking up and seeing it from that perspective. I love that.
Thank you.
A gorgeous turtle, and which I love. You write this poem about a turtle. You know, this notion that you could overlook something without realizing how much wisdom there might be with that, being content to move slowly and, again, seeing the world differently. And Megan, the images are great. How do you feel about what you see in the book from the photography side?
The editing to get to this book was tough, because by the time we were done, we had all the participants take all their photographs out on and just lay them out around the room. And my co-teacher, Sharon Turner, and I, with Karen Van Meenen, we're all walking around looking at all the photographs, and we have to pare it down because this book can't be like, you know, 200 pages. So the editing, they really did an excellent job, and it was really amazing to watch them work. And then once they did start writing and really opening up through that, finding images that paired well for the editing process in the book, too. So I'm so happy with it, and it really was such an honor to work with these women. And I flip through this book probably every day, just because I really still can't believe we were able to do this project this year. It was such an honor.
And the book is First Light, Eyes Front, Images and Words from Women Combat Veterans. You can find it where?
So you can pick up a copy at Flower City Arts Center at 713 Monroe Avenue here in Rochester, or you can also, with a $20 donation online, receive a copy of the book through the mail, too. And that's rochesterarts.org.
Rochesterarts.org. $20 contribution, and I promise you that holding this, it will be meaningful and moving as you read the stories, the poetry, see the images. It's powerful stuff, and as we move into the federal holiday on Monday, I think it's as timely as ever. So thank you, Megan. Megan is the Director of Photography and Digital Arts at Flower City Arts Center. Congratulations on this project, because, again, I don't think we say happy Veterans Day. I don't know that it's always a happy occasion, but I do congratulate you, because these are important stories, and so thank you for that.
Thank you again for having us.
Really great stuff. And some maybe 20 seconds apiece. What do you want to leave the audience with? What do you want them thinking about every day, but especially moving into Monday? Jennifer.
Well, Evan, I think you brought up a good point. Veterans Day isn't happy for every veteran, but acknowledge them on an everyday basis, or, you know, just be an active participant in a veteran's life and in one another's life. You know, we're all kind of going on this journey together. And just remember that, you know, 3 to 5 years out, It doesn't mean that their journey's over. It could just be beginning. I just met with a World War II veteran for the first time today, just starting her journey.
Beautiful. 20 seconds. What do you want people to be left with here?
I'd say realize that they're out there whether you know them or not, and respect them, appreciate it, and hold those that are close to you, that you love, because there are ones that are missing their loved ones tomorrow.
Thank you for this. I thought you were going to say, don't be afraid to cry.
Nope.
No, I'm not going to do that.
Not even close. But nice try, though.
I thought you were going to say, don't be afraid to date a veteran.
Be afraid of that.
No.
You want to be afraid of that.
I'm really grateful, Jade. Great having you. Thank you.
Thank
Jennifer,
you.
Thank you very much. And our thanks to the entire team here at Connections today. Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. Thanks to all the volunteers. And thanks for listening. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful weekend. We'll talk to you Monday on Veterans Day on Member Supported Public Radio.